Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 343rd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a singer-songwriter who has recorded and produced 32 albums over the last 45 years, several of which have gone gold and platinum. But what makes this three-time Grammy nominee such a trailblazer and a rarity is that his music has almost exclusively been created for children. Indeed, the Los Angeles Times called him, quote, the first children's music superstar, close quote, and, quote, the Springsteen of the preschool set, close quote. The New York Times said he is, quote, a superstar for the nursery school set, close quote, and is, quote, widely credited with setting a new standard for children's music, close quote. And the Washington Post described him as, quote, the most popular children's singer in the English-speaking world, close quote. I'm talking, of course, about Rafi Kavukian, the 2006 recipient of the Fred Rogers Integrity Award, who is better known to and loved by kids as simply Rafi. Over the course of our conversation, the 72-year-old and I discussed his own childhood, which he previously described in his 1999 autobiography, The Life of a Children's Troubadour, as, quote, melancholy, close quote. The invitation that in the early 70s led him, an aspiring folk singer and guitar player who was trying to be like Bob Dylan and James Taylor, to perform in front of children for the first time, and how that in turn led to his breakout 1976 children's album, Singable Songs for the Very Young, and his first concerts for children in 1977. Why, at a couple of points over the decades since, he has taken years-long breaks from writing and performing music, and how he came to devote a great chunk of his time to what he calls his legacy work, the Rafi Foundation for Child Honoring, which offers an online course in, quote, respecting Earth and Child, close quote, at rafifoundation.org, how this month he is marking the 40th anniversary of his greatest hit, Baby Beluga, with a Yo-Yo Ma collaboration and a new verse for the song that speaks to this fraught moment in time and is aimed directly at adults who grew up on his music, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Rafi, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's a real privilege to get to speak with you. Probably, 30 years after the last time I was in your presence, which was at a New Haven performance where I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. And anyway, just such a thrill to see you. And on this podcast, we always begin with just a few basics about our guests. Where were you born and raised? And what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Cairo, Egypt, of an Armenian family. My mother was a great storyteller. My father was a renowned portrait photographer, went by the name Kavuk, which is yes. My surname, just abridged a little.
And your father, I read, was actually a musician in his own right, right?
He was. He played violin, balalaika, and accordion like you wouldn't believe.
When you came to Toronto, you were about 10 years old, and I wanted to ask you just what precipitated that move, why your family decided to do the move, and also how you adjusted to life in Toronto, which I'd be curious to know why they picked Toronto as well.
Well, my father scouted out three locations in 1957. He said Montreal had too much snow. New York was too big, although he loved it. And he said Toronto felt just right. Plus, we knew a family that could sponsor us.
Got it. And it is, to this day, a city of a lot of immigrants and seems to be very welcoming.
Yeah, it was a great city for us to land in. It was great.
When you arrived, how was your English?
Spotty at best. I was learning it, in Cairo. I had learned a number of languages. I spoke Armenian at home, and I heard Turkish from my grandparents. I was speaking Arabic, the language of the land there. I was speaking, and I was learning in school French and English. So I had a little bit of English and was really quick learning it once I got to Toronto.
Many people from non-English language speaking countries who move to North America and are trying to learn English say that they find it very helpful to watch English language television or listen to English language music. Was listening to music something that, you know, you did when you got here, and was that helpful in a way?
Sure was. We used to have two pop radio stations that kind of fought each other for ratings. And, you know, to hear even Pete Seeger songs on pop radio at the time, This Land Is Your Land, then to hear the Beatles, the Stones, Motown, Dylan, Joni Mitchell. Oh, my God, what an amazing soundscape to learn English in. But I'll also say that the black and white television on Saturday nights, man, I watched Hockey Night in Canada, and my favorite player was Frank Mahovlich of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I want to tell you one more little detail. Saturday afternoons, there was the baseball game of the week, from a Buffalo station, either NBC or whatever it was. And I loved watching baseball. And you'll never guess who my favorite player was. Hank Aaron of the Milwaukee Braves at the time.
Yes, yes, yes.
Hank Aaron, the home run king. Now, isn't that interesting? This little, you know, pudgy Armenian guy, right? Comes to Toronto. He's 10, 11 years old. And who do I notice? Hank Aaron. There was something about this gentleman. He was a gentleman. And he could hit it out of the park. So
yes,
that combo, yeah.
That did it. Yeah, that's amazing. So you have said, quote, "The guitar has been my friend since I was 16, close quote. So how did you and that friend meet, and why did you hit it off?
Well, we met in the pawn shop where I laid down $24 and I said, I'll take that, please. And then I, you know, it was this nylon string Kent guitar, as I say, $24, which is probably $317 in today's money. Anyway, but I just started playing every song I could figure out, including, you know, Beatles songs and such. And wow, it was quite an opening of a new world for me to be able to play an instrument and have songs come alive.
So at that point, if you can take yourself back in time, what do you think was driving your interest in even getting a guitar? Some people, you know, might say, oh, it was a way to meet girls or to become a rock star. What was it for you?
It was a way to meet girls. And there's one other thing. In fifth grade, Mr. Horton brought a friend of his in one day, and he said, my friend's going to play us a song. And this guy came in with a 12-string guitar, and he played Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was an amazing, and I thought, I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, so as someone who has brought a lot of happiness to a lot of kids, I think people might assume that you must have come from a childhood that you would describe as happy yourself. And yet, reading your autobiography, I know that you've said that, you know, there were maybe more appropriate adjectives than that, like melancholy, and that, you know, you've said that you had some issues with your parents. And I just wonder if you, you know, as you look back today, all these years later, how do you remember your own childhood?
Well, it was a complex time. I remember the beauty of my surroundings in Cairo, especially because my family used to, on Sundays after church, we'd go to the pyramids in my father's Studebaker, two-tone green, I might add. But, you know, much as I delighted in, you know, playing in the Cairo sands and drinking pop, you know, and eating falafel sandwiches and such, there was at home a lot of tension. You know, we were an Armenian family, not in our homeland. And there were tensions in the parenting. I mean, I knew I was loved. That was the saving grace. I knew my parents loved me dearly. But did I feel respected for who I felt I was? No, I did not. And you might say that was the birth of the child-honoring philosophy I later came to espouse. But I do describe in my autobiography childhood as being a time of great bewilderment. If they loved me so much, why did I feel that at times they took out their frustrations on me?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like you actually did interact with your father in a musical capacity, in a sense, also, because wasn't he the choir master of the church choir that you were a part of. Was he respectful and did he recognize your talent at an early age?
I think that aspect of it was fairly good, yes. I mean, I always got nervous when I had to do solos in church and so on, but that's just, you know, part of it. But yeah, those beautiful, melancholy songs of the... the church service in Armenia were quite something. Beautiful harmonies, laden with harmonies, and soulful music. And I think that was actually, it's interesting you mentioned that. That was, you know, part of the ground of my musical being in my teenage years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the time comes and you eventually head off to the University of Toronto. I know you were off to a great start there, honor student, doing very well. And then a couple of weeks before your second year exams, you decided to check out.
That 6 weeks before.
6 weeks, 6 weeks. So that now that must have been a major decision. And I wonder what motivated it for you and how it went down with your parents to leave school, I guess, because you were going to go focus on being a musician.
Yeah, I was folk singing in second year. Mostly that's what I was doing. I wasn't going to class much. Playing guitar, writing songs, and just wanted to be a James Taylor. So, yeah, I'd heard somewhere that if you didn't follow your heart's calling, that you might regret it all your life. And I thought, I ain't regretting this. I'm just going to go give it a try. And my dean at the time said, oh, no, man, you got to stay. You got to cram, get your year and all this kind of stuff. And I said, it wouldn't mean anything to me if I did manage that. I don't think I could anyway. But I said to him, if I'm meant to be a teacher, which I thought I might do, I said, I'll come back and I'll study and become a proper teacher. But for now, I got to leave.
And what that involved, well, first of all, I guess, let me come back to how did your parents take that decision?
It was tough, but I had to do what I had to do.
And so you, I know, embarked on performing in coffee houses and clubs in Toronto and Montreal. I've read that you were hitchhiking to Vancouver, I believe. What was the music scene like that you were a part of in those days when you were just trying to make your name?
I remember being in Boston and hearing the song, Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, Woodstock, that Joni Mitchell covered so beautifully. I dreamed there were bombers in the sky, they turned into butterflies over our nation. Oh, man, the Vietnam War was raging. I mean, I was just shaking at what was happening in 1970, early 70s. It's interesting because, as I now recall, no wonder in 1974 I was glued to the black and white TV set watching the Watergate hearings. You can imagine how I feel currently.
Yes, we'll come to that. But I guess, you know, were you somebody who immediately found that you were comfortable performing in rowdy bars and coffee houses and all that?
It was a living. You know, I was trying to make a living as a folk singer. And sometimes it was a rowdy bar that paid well. Sometimes it was a folk club with 15 people in it, you know. And sometimes it was a folk music festival. I did play a few festivals. But in general, it wasn't the most comfortable career for me, So when children's music came and knocked on my heart, as it did in early 70s, and when I made that first album in 1976, mm-hmm. there was almost a relief in me of oh, there's this music that's important for children, and I seem to be good at it, or so I'm told when I go to the preschool and sit with kids on the floor and I'm making them laugh and having them join in. I thought, oh, well, this is interesting, you know.
And the kids aren't going to heckle you like at a bar or disregard.
It wasn't easy to let go of you know, my other singing, but my folk singing. But I came into a broader sense of myself, I think, learning about children. And I studied early childhood informally to get to know this new audience that I was, you know, I found myself in front of. And
well, I'd like to ask you about how that first time that you found yourself in front of children even came about. And I believe it started really with, you know, through your relationship with your then wife, and actually her mother-in-law. A lot of people, you know, the running joke is they complain about their mother-in-law. But in this case, your mother-in-law, I guess it was really her idea that set you on this path. Can you explain how you wound up in front of nursery school kids in the first place?
Yeah, she was an angel, my mother-in-law, then, and ran a nursery school in North Toronto. And she knew I sang, and she said, why don't you bring your guitar in and sing for the kids one day? And so I turned to my then wife, who was a kindergarten teacher, and I said, what should I sing? Because Baba Black Sheep was not part of my childhood, right? So mm-hmm. I had to come to learn word for word the children's classics, you know, the traditional songs that I started out with on that rug on the floor with a few kids and a couple of teachers. And then I was asked back. Oh, apparently it went well. I was asked back. And then once again. And so this led one day to the idea that, you know, an album for young children would be a really wonderful contribution to their lives. And, you know, make the songs singable, I was told, singable, so that children could make them their own. And I stopped to think, singable songs, that sounds good. Hey, I just got it that my first album had singable songs, and then my fourth one, Baby Beluga, the alliteration, I just got.
You like your alliteration.
And those are the two most successful of my albums, are the ones with alliteration in the title. I just got that.
That's great. That's great. I want to ask you, it sounds like actually singable songs for the very young was actually not your first album. That's your first that went big. But you, it's, at least according to the records that I've seen, you actually had an album the year before that was not targeted at children, but that you had recorded and also put out through your own label, Troubadour.
My first album, actually, that I founded my label on was called Good Luck Boy. And it was a sweet little folk album. And, you know, one of the songs that I wrote, which was called Feel Like a Million, it was a song about friends, was covered by George Hamilton IV, of all people. Imagine that. But, you know, in life, you have to kind of, at times, pay attention to what's happening. And as I said earlier, when the children's music, when the thought that this was important work, when that landed in my heart, and this heart of a frustrated folk singer who was never really going to be that successful at it, I came to understand that. When I was about ready to hang up the guitar, this other career opened up, and am I ever glad I said yes to it.
Yes. Well, you know, between that initial performance at the nursery school and the first children's targeted album, the second overall album, Singable Songs for the Very Young, which, as you say, came out in 76, were you early on able to deduce why children responded to you in particular? What was it that they were liking about you and your music?
Well, when Singable Songs came out, it seemed to be an overnight hit with all the parents who heard about it. They were buying it in threes and fours from me when I happened to be at a library or another preschool performance. There was something irresistible about that album, the music in it. I don't know. It helped, of course, that Danielle Lanois was the recording engineer for the first four of my children's albums.
And he later did U2 and all kinds of stuff, right?
He did, yeah. Neville Brothers, U2, and he's just a phenomenal musician. But he was a recording engineer. Ken Whiteley, multi-instrumentalist. I couldn't have done that first album without him. He stayed with me for several albums, you know, and he guided the musical production and such. So that was great. But I think there was something in my voice, in my way of offering a song to children. I could be excited, but I never drove them to frenzy. It wasn't my aim. That's too easy to do that, and it doesn't respect your young audience. I thought of, you know, the song meeting them halfway type of thing. But the most important thing maybe is that there was a playfulness in my singing, and play is what young children understand even before they know that that's what they understand, because they're immersed in it. That's their way of being. So I think when they heard the playfulness in my voice, they felt I was a friend. And I think that's still true.
I guess I think it's interesting the logistics of, you know, you had no way of knowing with that album that it was going to be the phenomenon that it became. Can you just set the scene of how grassroots an effort it was even to put the album together? And I mean, it's 19 songs, some of which are pre-existing that you did your own take on, like Down by the Bay, I believe.
Down by the bay, down by the bay, where the watermelons grow. Back to my home, I dare not go, for if I do, my mother will say.
Did you ever have a time when you couldn't make a rhyme?
Down by the bay, down by the bay, where the watermelons grow. Back to my home, I dare not go.
So, I mean, I guess when you went to the nursery school, you mentioned you were performing songs that your wife had kind of, that you had to learn, the pre-existing songs. That's a very different thing from then going and becoming a talented writer of children's songs as well. Just
a couple of originals on that first album, and then an adaptation of Old MacDonald had a band. You know, I was still, you know, mostly with traditional songs and just two or three of my own for the next three albums. Even on Baby Beluga, 1980, my fourth album. Mm-hmm. I think there were three originals, maybe four. Fourth one was an instrumental. Baby Beluga, All I Really Need, Thanks a Lot. And it blew my mind that people told me they loved those songs as much, if not more, than the other material. I went, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Gee, I think I've got something here.
Well, I would guess that maybe even before that, there must have been a moment kind of like that, because the year after Singable Songs for the Very Young came out, you started performing, not like just for a nursery school, but a real concerts for the first time. And when you show up there and find out that people already know all the lyrics to and songs that you've had on your album, what's that moment like?
Ah, a good moment. Really good. Yeah. I remember that was the case not only in Canada. I was performing around Toronto. 1981, my first performance in Portland, Oregon, first time south of the border. The concert had been set up by a children's bookstore where my albums were sold. I don't think cassettes were happening right then. But anyway, again, same thing. 500-seater was sold out just on the fact that enough people bought my album and loved my album that they told everybody about it. We had two shows there. It was amazing. And they all sang along with me. Now, mind you, I also had folk singer chops from my Pete Seeger adoration and so on. And I knew what a good singer Pete Seeger was. When I say singer, what I mean is he engaged his audience so beautifully. I learned from him how to engage an audience. And so my folk singer chops came in handy.
I think he, like you, also encouraged his audience to sing with him, right? Which is not something, not every singer likes that.
No, I loved it right from the start. It was great because it was about the more we get together. That was the spirit of it.
Oh, the more we get together, 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 the more we get together, the happier we'll be. There's Chris and Tanya and Jason and Justin. The more we get together, the happier we'll be. Okay, are you ready?
And I think it's not a coincidence that you would typically, I believe, open your concerts with that song, right?
Yeah.
How did you arrive at the idea? I believe that from the very beginning, your concerts were generally 45 minutes. How did you know that was the length that would work with this audience?
Well, in the early 70s, if you said to someone, well, what's a young child's attention span? They'd say, what attention span? And also, interesting, at that time, the phrase, the very young, at that time meant 3 to 7-year-olds, not 0 to 4.
And that really became a bit of an issue, right? Because people were bringing infants.
Well, yeah, but even apart from that, yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I did need to you know, come to know how to work with the evolving situation. But 45 minutes seemed like, you know, plenty. Like you came, you know, we were all together. And the other thing I did, apart from saying these concerts are 45 minutes in length, I said that right on the poster, right up front. So I chose not to have an intermission. And I chose not to separate the kids from their families, from their parents, to come down on stage, you know, a few of them.
Yeah.
Or 100 of them or something, you know. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want parents pointing at their kids. I wanted the family singing together with me. So those are two things that were, I think, pioneering in my concerts. And I'm glad I did it that way.
Absolutely. I guess let's come back to Baby Beluga for a moment, because this was in 1980. The album of that name with the song, obviously, of that name came out. And I guess, you know, because it is maybe as closely associated with you as any song, I'd be curious to know what, if anything, specifically inspired you to write a song about belugas, and why you think that song in particular has resonated so much with now generations of kids.
Well, in 1979, I was performing in Vancouver. I think I had two or three children's albums out that time. And I went to the aquarium, first-rate aquarium in Vancouver, and they had a beluga pool where they had two belugas. And Kavna, the beluga that I met, because I was going to write a Save the Whale song, and I introduced myself to the aquarium people, and they let me come on to the platform right by the pool, and they introduced me to Kavna. I was starstruck. What a magnificent creature. Oh my goodness. Not only that, but with the trainer's help, Kavna came up out of the water, this rather large creature, and kissed me on the cheek with her nose.
Wow.
She could have easily knocked me over.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
Right? She did that twice. I couldn't stop talking about it for like a month. Anyway, I went back to Toronto and decided that my Save the Whale song would be a love song. Because if you love something, you want to protect it. Mm-hmm. And it was suggested to me I make it about a baby whale. And I said, why? And the answer is because children love babies. So.
Baby beluga in the deep blue sea, swim so wild and you swim so free. Heaven above and the sea below, and a little white whale on the go. Baby beluga, baby beluga, is the water warm? Is your mama home with you so happy?
It seems like your interest in environmentalism, in animals, just in the health of the world at large, that was already in place way back then?
Yep.
What do you think started that?
Well, I think the movement to save whales. I mean, even in the early 40s, we were concerned about the state of whales worldwide. That was one thing. Mm-hmm. But you may remember that in my autobiography, when I was 13, I won a poster contest. I drew a poster of a peaceful forest scene. At the top of it, it said, keep it peaceful. And there was a tree in the middle with a little sign that said, no hunting, and a bird perched on it. So these things are mysterious, you know, how influences come to you and how you grow up to be the person you become. There was something, even back then, to the city dweller, you know, living in Toronto. But occasionally, my family would take a drive out to see the fall colors of the leaves, right? And, oh, I would just be so delighted to see the beauty. That had an effect on me. So I did this poster, and I won this contest, the Smokey the Bear Fire Prevention Poster Contest. So I'm just citing that as another interesting little nature awareness, because I wanted it peaceful. And I wanted there to be no hunting. How's that for a guy who then goes on decades later to have a philosophy called child honoring that has 9 principles, one of which is nonviolence.
Absolutely. It was there. The seed was there very early, clearly. What do you think the role was? It seems like your rise to prominence coincided with the rise of the audio cassette and the video cassette. So obviously there were record albums and LPs or whatever before, but do you think that there was something about the fact that kids could pop in either a cassette or a video, a audio or a video cassette so easily and have you around at any time that really solidified their relationship with you in a way that might otherwise have been impossible?
That's an interesting point. The cassette may have had something to do with the growth of my popularity, but I think it was still parents, by and large, who made the purchase. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. important to remember. And parents told me they felt great about, you know, buying my music because they didn't have to leave the room when the kids wanted to hear it.
Yes, yes. As these albums were coming out and your popularity was growing, how did you handle the idea of, you know, just being a well-known person? I know that kids are maybe not gonna, on the one hand, it might be a different sort of fame than if it were, you know, the Rolling Stones or something. But on the other hand, I'm sure it changed your life in a lot of ways. And I just wonder how you adapted.
Well, I was thankfully doing yoga and doing meditation at the time. And that helped, you know, just to kind of stay centered and grounded amidst the growing popularity. But certainly I remember doing shows in Vancouver at the Vancouver International Children's Festival at the time in the early 80s. They kept making the Raffi tent bigger.
Yeah.
Finally, we had a 1,000-seat tent, and I was doing like 10 shows. I mean, it was just during the week. It was amazing. But, you know, clearly I'd come to make a comfortable living, and I was so grateful that I said yes to this important work. I was growing as a person. I was learning all about early childhood as the foundation of human development. And that learning certainly was important when the child honoring vision came knocking on my door. But the more, you know, the more I learned about early childhood and the people that we become based on that first early experience, because you're either hemmed in by that first experience, or it becomes something that, you know, if it's an experience of constraint, you have to at some point heal that experience, because your spirit as a child is not one of constraint. It's one of possibility. So I think understanding the nature of the young child, the creativity, the wonder, played an interesting second fiddle to my, you know, appreciation of the natural world, my desire that we not foul our nest, you know. And it's interesting, I mean, it's interesting to as I'm doing in this conversation with you, I'm hopping back and forth between decades. I mean, currently, my Raffi Foundation, our slogan is respecting earth and child. Mm-hmm. Well, how mm-hmm. sweet is that?
Perfect.
It's an integrated vision, because to do our best for the child, we have to do our best for Mother Earth, whose children we are. It can't be any other way.
Yeah, and you said that in your TED Talk as well, mm-hmm. in a very, you know, powerful way. In 1987, you put out an album called Everything Grows, which the title song of that, I think, is one of your most beautiful.
Yes, everything grows and grows. Babies do, animals too. Everything grows. Everything grows and grows. Sisters do, brothers do. Everything grows.
So it seems like, you know, by all appearances from the outside, things were really going great in your career. And yet in September 89, you're 41 years old and you held a farewell concert at Carnegie Hall. People were clamoring to get in and scalping tickets and everything. Why did you decide at that point to sort of stop making and performing music for a while? And what were some of the things that you learned during that hiatus over the next few years?
I needed a rest, for one thing. I needed a year where I didn't have another conscious schedule. You know, it's really good for touring musicians to do that. But during that year, I also noticed, I paid attention to the state of the world. 1989 was when Time magazine put Planet Earth on the cover. Do you remember that? And and it said Planet of the Year. I mean, instead of Person of the Year. And the Earth was actually in flames. Well, that, not just that, but a five-part radio series, CBC radio series with David Suzuki about global warming. 1989. Mm-hmm. Called It's a Matter of Survival. Those two things really powerfully moved me. And I felt that I wanted to take some time and do something different. That's why I recorded what I call my ecology album, Evergreen, Everblue. I was all excited about maybe going in a different direction, maybe singing to older kids, kids old enough who can make a difference, because it's not the job of a five-year-old to save this earth. But to say the least, even though the album, you know, has done fairly well, it's, you know, had a quarter million or more in sales, which is not bad for an environmental album. But it didn't, you know, it wasn't the remake of Raffi, if you will. Mm-hmm. That didn't work out. So, and also my marriage ended at that time. It was a very challenging 2 or 3 years. But I returned back to the concert stage in 1994. Interestingly, 1994 was Banana Phone. Boop-a-doop-a-doop.
Boop-a-doop-a-doop. Ring, 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 Banana Phone. Ring, 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 Banana Phone. I've got this feeling so appealing for us to get together and sing.
Ring, ring, ring. So yes. By then I regained my mojo and my my laughter and my, you know, I was playful again.
Absolutely. Well, just to come back to one thing that I read about during that period of, I guess, 4 years when you were away from the public eye, you have spoken about the fact that there were things that you were finding about yourself that had maybe changed since you had become a public figure that you were yourself not especially happy with. You talked about the fact that when you were recording things with, for instance, your wife and two other collaborators at the time, you would find yourself, this was, I think, in your autobiography, quote, being upset if the three of them were having too good a time, close quote, or things like that, where I wonder if, was it just sort of perfectionism, or was that something about what had happened?
No, there was the perfectionist in me, of course, and I worked through emotional counseling to deal with that. I traded it in for happiness.
One thing along the way to starting your current work, I think this was a year before before you had the vision to of what child honoring even was. That was in 97, but the year before something happened in your life, and I wonder if it's not related. And that is that I've heard people say that when you're in a way always a child until both of your parents are gone. And in your case, you, within something crazy, like just a few hours, lost both of your parents in 1995. How hard was that for you to go through that transition in your own life? And then do you think it had anything to do with your shortly thereafter coming upon this idea of child honoring?
Well, losing both parents on the same day is extremely difficult. You suddenly feel orphaned, you know. But you also take a deep breath and you grow up yet again. You know, you're now your own father type of thing. I wrote about it. Well, that's, in fact, as you know, in my autobiography, that's the first story I tell. It's called Pas de Deux. But I don't think that was a factor in the child-honoring vision coming. I think that I was writing essays during that time about how a child-honoring world, child-hyphen-honoring world might look. What would it be for a society to honor its young? I was asking that question, writing an essay or two here and there. And I think the reading I was doing at the time, Our Stolen Future, was one book by Theo Kohlborn and two other writers. And don't forget that I had met Al Gore in 1991 and read his book, Earth in the Future, in which he talked about how ecology should be the central organizing principle of society. That really made an impact on me. But by 96, I was saying to myself, ecology is a great word, but nobody knows it. And I said to myself, when you said the word ecology, if you thought of your young child, if the face of your young child was linked to a philosophy that became the central organizing principle of a society, that might have power in it.
And so it started out really with this vision in 97, then a three-paragraph covenant for honoring children in 99, then nine child-honoring principles in 2000, and then eventually what we now know as the Raffi Foundation dealing with child honoring. And I wonder, for somebody who hasn't yet read your autobiography or you know, become acquainted with the foundation, when you talk about child honoring, I'm trying to think what somebody might, they hear child honoring, they might think, you know, just let the kid do what they want or whatever. Can you define what you mean by child honoring?
Yeah, and thank you for that, because I've said for a long time it's not about it's not about permissive parenting at all. That wouldn't honor the child. And it's not about a world where children rule, far from it. It's the opposite, actually. It's about a society that values its young, a society that creates the opportunities for every family to do well. I mean, if you ask me what kind of economy I would want to see, I would say one in which no child goes hungry. And that's not a political statement, that's a human statement. Because, Scott, if you argued the opposite, I would dare you to name which child should go hungry. Mm-hmm. It's morally repugnant to think of a world where some must go hungry. So child honoring is both a philosophy and it's a way of life, and it's a lens through which we see a world that might have its priorities reordered. Mm-hmm. Because it's really about redesigning society for the greatest good by meeting the priority needs of the very young. Now, I'll pause there and say, the priority needs of the very young are both universal. All young children need the same thing, mm-hmm. interestingly. And they are irreducible. They're not entitlements in the negative sense. Every child is entitled to love, to dream, to belong in a loving village. So with young children, entitlement is the way it is. That's what they need to be healthy, to grow up with a positive, affirming sense of their first impressions of life. So child honoring is a call to all of us who care about children, who care about this beautiful Mother Earth, to live with respect for one another. Respect has been the core value throughout my career.
And you really do practice what you preach in ways that I don't know how many other people could be so faithful to their core beliefs, because let's just, if I can just note a few things that you've done that really made an impression on me. I understand that you turned down what must have been a very lucrative offer from the producers of Shrek to turn Baby Beluga into an animated movie. Because what reason, can I ask you?
Because they would be marketing it directly to children through fast food outlets and whatever, and can't have that. It's mm-hmm. not ethical to advertise and market something directly to children who are too young to understand what is being pitched at them.
You also, apparently, I believe, have always turned down commercial endorsement offers as well for similar reasons.
Yeah. It's never been about anything but the music. I didn't want to use the music to sell something, so to sell a product.
Right.
Unfair.
And then the last of these examples I just want to mention, because I think it's very it's worth noting is you were offered what a lot of musicians would consider a dream gig to perform at Madison Square Garden, from what I understand, and you declined to do so. For what reason?
It wouldn't have been a happy thing for little kids and their families. Too big a venue.
Yeah. So here we are, 40 years after Baby Beluga, and you have just recently released a new version of the song in collaboration with Yo-Yo Ma. And I wonder if you can just explain how that came about and why you've added the verse that you did, because I think it's very special to see you still singing the song, but also speaking to the current moment.
Thank you. During this pandemic, Yo-Yo Ma found himself, of course, not touring, and he at some point started collaborating with other musicians in what he called songs of comfort. He used that hashtag. And so he reached out to me to see if I would do a collaboration with him. When I mentioned Baby Beluga and when I mentioned the new verse, he said, "That sounds great. You've got to include the new verse." So that's how that came about. I recorded it from my kitchen on Salt Spring Island. Talk about coast-to-coast physical distancing.
And he, that's right.
and he performed so beautifully from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The song, you've said, is in a way aimed at what you call beluga grads, which I guess I am one of them.
Yeah, baby.
What's a beluga grad for people who don't know? And what is the message of the new verses, the new verse that you've added?
Well, a beluga grad is an adult who when a child was singing Raffi songs, you know, including Baby Beluga. And the last verse basically says, grown up beluga, sing a song of peace, sing a song of diversity, of child honoring, social justice, climate action. We need to hear you. So it's a call to action to the tens of millions of beluga grads who have grown up with this music to take part in the mobilization of awareness and action to deal with the climate threat that is upon us, which is going to make the pandemic look like it was just a minor matter when we finally wake up to this other imminent threat that the whole world is affected by. So I also recorded, you may know this, I recorded a song inspired by Greta Thunberg and the millions of climate strikers. And I really stretch out when I write these songs that are not in the children's genre, you know? And this is an up-tempo song called Young People Marching. So I'm doing whatever I can to bring awareness and inspire people to do their part for our lives, for our children's futures. I like to say the young have a first call on our moral duty to stabilize climate and secure their future.
Now you've grown and you're on your way, making waves in the boundless bay. You're shining light and your dreams alive for the ones you've brought this way. Grown up beluga, grown up beluga. Sing a song of peace, sing a song of diversity, child honoring, social justice, climate action. We need to hear you. You beluga grads and me on the go.
With our last minute or two, can I just do something we like to end on called rapid fire? Just the first sentence or so that comes to your mind about a random assortment of topics. So over the period in which you've been a high profile public performer, which really basically coincides with my lifetime, it seems like our society has become more cynical, jaded, coarse. How have you managed not to become that? It seems like you are still the same sunny, optimistic person you've always been.
I'm playful.
Yeah.
that's yeah. important. Play is a vibe all its own, you know. And also I have the child in me very, very much alive and wondrous and curious. I'm curious about everything.
Have you noticed that the children in your audiences have changed over the years? Is there any marked difference?
No, the world around them changes, so that affects them. But their irreducible universal needs at the start of life, that does not change. Their need for respect, for respectful love, their need for nourishment, affection, shelter, all of that doesn't change.
Some people are surprised to learn that you are on Twitter and that you will engage on matters of, you know, politics and current events. If you could say today, not on Twitter, but just verbally, anything to the president of the United States, someone who's presided over things that affect children in, I'm sure, ways that you're not happy about at the border and things like that, what would you most want to communicate to him?
I would communicate my words to the electorate. Mm-hmm. I would say resist fascism, defend democracy, and vote.
What is it most important for kids to be thinking about during the pandemic, which has obviously rocked their lives?
Well, it's tough for kids because they've been confined for a long time. So it's a time for kindness, by not only by kids, but by the parents that they're living in. And sometimes they're in tiny apartments. Sometimes they're in homes, but they're still not able to see their friends and hug their grandparents and so on. Speaking of kindness, I did want to mention, I'm going to mention an album that's all about kindness. It's an album by Massachusetts singer Lindsay Monroe. It's called I Am Kind, Songs for Unique Kids. I mentioned the album not because I produced it, which I did, but because, honestly, this is such a beautiful expression of kindness, not just the title song, but through the vibration throughout the whole album, and I highly recommend this.
Absolutely. What is your favorite song to perform at your concerts?
Besides Baby Beluga? it might be Banana Phone, because I make banana jokes afterwards.
Yes.
And everybody knows the jokes and they still laugh. It's so stupid.
Does any part of you say to yourself quietly, because I know you don't say it out loud, but, oh God, I have to sing whatever, you know, Baby Beluga again?
I just think about my audience. I think, oh, they're here to sing with me. And I bet we're going to have fun with this one. That's how I look at it.
Do you sing in the shower?
Hey. Doesn't everyone?
What is a well-known song that people might be surprised to learn that Raffi loves? Maybe outside of your genre.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday.
That's a beautiful one, absolutely. What is the biggest misconception about Raffi?
That he has no last name. That he still wears Argyle socks. I don't, I tell you. It was just a phase.
Last three of these quick ones. You never had children of your own. I know you've often been asked about that. And I wonder, is that something you have ever wished you had had? It seems like you would have been a fabulous parent, but obviously you, as they say in Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the movie and the book, the line there at the end when the teacher is dying, he says, quote, "I thought I heard you saying it was a pity I never had any children, but you're wrong. I have thousands of them, and all boys." So I think about you when I mean, you have more children than anybody, but
I have more girls, actually.
That's right.
I don't know. It was one of those things. It was a personal decision, and my albums became my children in a way, but I'm young yet, you know, I'm only 72, so hey.
Yeah, get on it. So lastly, I guess, what's it like when you meet grown-ups who were fans of yours when they were kids, like outside of a concert setting where they're bringing their own kids? But I mean, there must be some pretty memorable moments at cash registers and with waiters and all kinds of things. So what's that like for you?
It's always an honor to meet some fans, you know, in the grocery store aisle who want a selfie right there, you know, and we just have fun with it. I just stay playful with it.
Well, on behalf of my family and this going gray beluga grad right here, I want to thank you so much for all the happy memories that you provided and for doing this. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. I really enjoyed this romp through yesteryear. And yeah, I send my love to all my fans and all those who are afflicted with this virus and all those families who've lost loved ones, all those who are struggling, and to all the essential workers on whom we depend. I not only say thank you, but I want to say to you, Scott, that I've written and recorded a new song, which will be released in a couple of weeks. And it's got Lindsay Monroe singing with me. It's a duet with her. And you're never going to guess who's going to join us. Yo, yo, ma.
Ah, fantastic.
And the song is called For All You Do. It says, we can say thank you for all you do.
Well, that's awesome. And thank you for all you do. And stay safe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/Scott Feinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.